Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report Under Lockdown. I'm John Iderola, and I am mostly sure that everything is going to work. It's one of those days where I sort of just started the show, and it's like, is everything ready? I don't know. But I do know that we have one thing to fall back on if stuff starts to fray around the edges, and that is Emma Vigeland, who joins us once again on the show.
My charm is just going to radiate through the entire broadcast and make everything better.
Yes, we're going to be suffused with the radiation of your charm. Exactly. We're going to have abnormal cell growth and maybe learn a thing or two along the way.
And get brain cancer.
Exactly. You know, as if we were broadcasting from right beside a windmill. But anyway, that's Trump's theory. Anyway, yep. Thank you for joining us. Very glad to have you here. I know that you just did a live video on your channel as well. You want to plug that so people know where they can see more of your work?
Sure. YouTube.com/RebelHQ. Follow me there. I am churning out content every day. Lots and lots of content. That's what millennials like, and I'm giving it to them.
They are big fans of the content, and so we're going to try to give them some of that here as well. I know that a lot of you are already in the chat. Thank you so much for that. If you could go just one step further by lightly smashing that like button, as annoying people on the internet say, that would be great. More people will know about the stream and they can get involved as well. Hopefully, we can make a couple of them into a good progressive. So that'll be nice in 4 years or so to have a few more of those. So anyway, we got a lot that we're going to be talking about on the show today. In just a little bit, we're going to be talking about one of the most, just the most awful videos that I've ever seen in my life, but potentially a little bit of justice coming in that. We've got a whistleblower complaint from the government's top coronavirus vaccine developer. That is going to be a real doozy. A little bit of a roundup on how serious Donald Trump appears to be taking coronavirus as he pushes increasingly so for the country to reopen. And let's see. Oh, the New York primary suddenly looking a little bit more like an election once again. So we've got that. And we're going to touch base with the border wall, something we have not talked about in a little bit. So a little little update on that as well. With that, you ready to jump into it?
Oh, am I ready?
There is a very good chance that over the last day or so, you've seen a video going around. I saw it being shared on Twitter by Sean King, and it shows effectively a murder in broad daylight of a man named Ahmaud Arbery, who was hunted down by two white men and murdered, having apparently committed no crime whatsoever. There is the possibility of a little bit of progress. This is a case that's been sort of ongoing for some time now. The video is new, and we're going to show it to you in just a little bit, but understand that as of yesterday, a Georgia prosecutor said that a grand jury should decide whether to bring charges in the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old unarmed black man who was pursued by two white men and shot in southern Georgia in February, as video begins to spread. So that you understand what we're talking about here and how severe and difficult to comprehend this case is, we are going to show you the video. It is the only video known to exist of the actual incident. Obviously, it does, although it's grainy and it's filmed from far away, it does show a person being killed. So, like, all the warnings imaginable on this. So understand that, and we'll play that now. And that is the video. And as we described, it is two men. We're going to give you more details, but it's two men who decided to chase down someone that they say they had a vague suspicion might have committed a crime. And they brought guns because you bring a gun when you want to potentially use a gun. And he ended up being shot multiple times with a shotgun at extremely close range and died almost instantly.
That's a lynching.
Yeah.
That's a lynching. So when you have Republican politicians downplaying lynching, and we've seen it in Southern Republicans constantly, you know, trying to basically whitewash history and pretend like it isn't living history. Like, we don't see this on, at least shadows of this or versions of this on a daily basis. No, this is just a lynching. Two white men following a black guy, terrorizing him and murdering him in broad daylight because they just had a hunch. They just had a hunch he did something wrong. I mean, the details on this are still fairly vague, but that's as plain as could possibly be. And like your heart just skips many beats when you hear those shotguns, those shots go off. I mean, it's hard, obviously, extremely hard to watch.
Yeah, and you see the victim there is just like a few pixels, but you, if you are a thinking person with an ounce of empathy, you immediately think, what if that had been me or someone I know? That the time, like, your life is about to end because of these two insane individuals. You have just a couple of seconds warning when they pull up and accost you. You try to defend yourself and you're dead, and that's it. Like, that fast. That's how fast a life can end if you're in a certain part of America, if you're facing a certain sort of American. That's what happens.
And now, if you are a certain sort of American, 100%. If you have a complexion that allows for white terrorists like this to feel justified in murdering you in broad daylight. It's in the middle of the day on the street. I mean, I don't even know how that video was shot, but that was someone seemingly suspicious that something was going wrong and just following them. And they still did it. There's a car right behind them.
Exactly. Yeah. They know that they can be watched. It's a broad daylight, middle of a street. And they did what they did. Now, to give you just a few more details before more commentary, he was jogging in a neighborhood outside Brunswick. This is February 23rd. One of the individuals and his son, so he's a former police officer. That's caused some of the complications in this case. There's obvious conflict of interest when it's not only a former police officer, but someone who'd worked with the district attorney. According to the only witness in the police report, McMichael told investigators he thought Arbery was a burglary suspect and ordered him to stop. McMichael said Arbery violently attacked his son and the two fought over the shotgun before Travis shot him twice. At the time, no charges were filed. So here's the thing. There is no evidence that this individual committed any crime. But even if they did, who the hell cares? It seems like there's a fundamental divide in this country along a lot of different lines. But one is, are you allowed to brutally murder someone if you think they burglarized a house? We should probably add, of course, people's answer to that is going to be, in some cases, entirely dependent on the race of the person doing the burglarizing. I, for one, think that even if someone broke into a house, you don't get to execute them. But unfortunately, a significant chunk of America thinks, yeah, totally acceptable. They committed a crime, they transgressed, and that is the only justification necessary for me to do what I wanted to do anyway, which is to hunt someone down and kill them.
Yeah, this isn't Rambo, because you're actually just a pimply-faced loser who really doesn't care about anything and would be actually the villain in any story. And additionally, we talk about what leads people to commit petty crimes like burglary, things like that. Often it's poverty. Often it's drug addiction. And we've seen that more and more white people are getting addicted to opiates, and it's raised a lot of questions among people on the right about tough on crime stances, et cetera. So say it was one of those guys' cousins who is addicted to opiates and broke into a house and tried to get some money to pay for their addiction. Do you think that they would be okay with shooting that person down? No, because they have empathy for their cousin. They have empathy for the guy they know that's addicted to heroin. But, and I'm not even saying that a crime was committed here, but just a mental exercise. Just go that much further in your empathy tree. And it's not that hard. It takes a little bit of mental toughness, but I think you can do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one other thing that I was thinking about, because this, to me, it feels reminiscent of Trayvon Martin, the experience. Someone being hunted down by someone who feels like the law is up to them, that they're Judge Dredd. They get to do the investigation, they get to do the arrest, and they get to do the execution if they want to. And it feels like the same thing, because the argument that is being made feels the same. It's the person attacked me, and so what am I going to do? I had to kill them. But there's so much that's left out of that. I mean, think about this. Obviously, guns are tools that can kill someone. But also, in America, they are a leading justification for killing someone, although not in a way that's made obvious, not by gun manufacturers. All you have to do is carry a gun with you when you have no reason to, accost someone, if they do literally anything to resist, you have presented a tool that you can make the case could be used against you. And so now because you brought it into the equation, and because they exist near you, you get to use it as a justification to kill them. It's what they're doing here. It's what Trayvon Martin did. In both cases, does anyone actually believe that if the assailant hadn't brought a gun, that anyone would be dead? If George Zimmerman hadn't brought his gun, he wants you to believe that Trayvon Martin would have beaten him to death with his bare hands. No rational person believes that. Nobody thinks that Arbery, who was just jogging, would have been stopped by two men without guns and would have killed them both. He would have killed them dead with his bare hands in the street. No one thinks that. These individuals are bringing guns not only to kill someone, but also to provide the excuse necessary to get away with it.
Exactly. It's the kind of both sidesing that obfuscates and muddies the waters when we're having this kind of conversation. It allows white racists who want to believe that that could be an alternative because it allows them to continue to think the way that they think. It allows them to have a get out of jail free card, no pun intended, when discussing issues like this, because then they get to say, oh, so dangerous. We need this gun to arm ourselves. Of course, that's not the reality. It's just a shield for them to not have any introspection about their own views.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I saw a response from, I believe it was one of the lawyers in this case, who said, if these people actually cared about enforcing the law, they could have easily driven to find where this person is and then called the police and led the police to them, if that's what they actually cared about. They didn't do that. And they didn't bring the guns, like, randomly. They brought the guns to justify using the guns.
These people don't care. Their masculinity is so fragile. I mean, that's what sticks out to me, too. That it's just pathetic, gross men who have no idea what it actually takes to be men.
Yeah, it makes me sick that anything like this ever happened, but the fact that it is still happening should be unacceptable. But it's one of the things that, again, it's controversial to have a problem with this. Like, most right-wing media is never going to talk about this story, of course, because they know deep down inside how bad it looks. But if they did, they justify it the same way they eventually did with Trayvon Martin. And then some of them, you know, the philosophical gladiators like Ben Shapiro will then tweet mockingly about the victim years later, because they're serious people that care about the law. Anyway, the entire thing makes me sick. I'm glad that the fact that the video came out and that it has gone viral, thanks in large part to a lot of people online, including Sean King. Many people watched it from when he posted it, that they are at least going to look into it. But a grand jury being brought about is no guarantee that there's going to be justice, particularly because one of the individuals involved in this killing was involved with law enforcement. So we're going to see, but how confident should anyone be that someone's going to end up in jail as a result of this?
Yeah, just should give you a little bit of confidence in the kind of selection process that goes into police officers, especially down south.
Exactly.
I have zero confidence that any cops in this country are better people than the average Joe. I mean,
yeah,
there's no vetting process. And honestly, I don't even care. Sometimes people go into that profession because they want to feel big and tall, and like they have power over you and leer over human beings, and to justify their taste for violence and blood. And it seems like this guy's one of those.
Exactly.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
The government's top coronavirus vaccine developer is now out with a whistleblower complaint against the government, making clear a number of different issues that he had, both during the coronavirus response and leading up to it, with cronyism and corruption and incompetence and ignorance. And it's available online, the 63-page complaint. We're not obviously going to cover all of it, but there are a few highlights from what Rick Bright said that I think it's important that you see. And understand that he'd worked up until recently at the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. It'll be called BARDA from now on. But so he was an insider in this response, one of the top insiders. And here's a few of the things that he says. On April 22nd, Bright alleged in a fiery statement that he had been sidelined because he, quote, resisted efforts to fund potentially dangerous drugs promoted by those with political connections. One of the drugs was the malaria medication hydroxychloroquine. Bright said he had rightly resisted efforts to provide an unproven drug on demand to the American public. And we're going to have a little bit more details on that in just a moment, but a bit more from the complaint. According to it, Bright's superiors at the Department of Health and Human Services began pressuring him to ignore expert recommendations and instead to award lucrative contracts based on political connections and cronyism starting around the spring of 2017. So this is not just during the epidemic. This is in the years leading up to it. We have an example of that sort of cronyism. Last fall, Bright, quote, rejected pressure by Dr. Kadlec to invest millions of dollars in a drug developed at Emory University by a longtime friend of Dr. Kadlec, presented as a miracle cure for influenza, Ebola, and nearly every other virus, even though the developer had not yet conducted clinical trials, and no data had been compiled to demonstrate either the efficacy or safety of the drug in humans. But that wasn't going to stop them from sending millions of dollars to someone that they knew and wanted to support. And so we're going to have more, but Emma, I know that you did a video about this whistleblower complaint, so give me some of your thoughts.
It's just, what sticks out to me most is how Trump's incompetence and his kind of ADD when it comes to dealing with this pandemic, where he can't focus on a larger goal and do what's necessary, like more testing, more supplies, more masks, all of that, how that kind of his tentacles extend into the other parts of the government here, where basically it wasn't just him pontificating on the podium about hydroxychloroquine and that miracle drug there. It was being felt in terms of what was being done in the government. Mm-hmm. And this is why this whistleblower spoke out. He had been speaking out, as you mentioned, before on the administration's lack of effort when it comes to dealing with coronavirus leading up to this. But really what broke the camel's back here was that hydroxychloroquine was not being tested. We found out later in the VA study that it may have no effect. In fact, it may have negligible or negative effects on patients who are dealing with coronavirus. And he had tried to speak out about that, and he was demoted. Mm-hmm. And so these government agencies are operating as if Trump would operate. And so when we talk about like good people in the government that still remain, I don't know how many people there are there, because this seems to be exactly as how Trump would behave if he were directly in charge of, you know, Health and Human Services and all of the agencies there.
Exactly. Yeah. The new people that are put in are loyalists above all else. And the people who remain, if they weren't loyalists, he's been weeding them out since the very beginning. There might be a few left. Fauci is still allowed to occasionally tell the truth.
And even Dr. Burps, though, I feel like we don't talk enough about how she seems to be parroting a lot of what Donald Trump says. I don't know if you have talked about it, but I feel like it's not discussed. You have. But people are always like, oh, Fauci and Burks. Like, no, there's one guy. There's one soldier left.
When she like a month ago was like, you know, I just have to say, he really pays attention to all the scholarship, and he's a mind for numbers. And I was like, no, you're not a serious person. Nobody actually thinks that. You're lying to me.
I don't trust women wearing light scarves like that. Those scarves look too expensive, and, you know, spend your money elsewhere.
That is the standard I will now use. So really fast, a little bit more from the complaint, and this takes us up to the pandemic. In a January 23rd meeting, Bright demanded urgent access to funding, personnel, and clinical specimens necessary to develop life-saving medicines for use in a possible pandemic. He was met with reassurances from HHS brass that the virus's spread was under control, according to the complaint, which is what we were hearing publicly, by the way. Bright was unable to get Cadillac, the doctor we talked about before, and HHS to take the threat seriously, the complaint states, leading a prominent N95 mask manufacturer to write to Bright saying, Rick, I think we're in deep S. And that was in the end of January. Now look, is it possible that he's exaggerating the extent to which he took it seriously when others didn't? Maybe. But it looks like he's got some documentation of his efforts to try to get them to take it seriously and all of these mitigation efforts. Even just the lowest bar is making PPE available. We knew that we needed that, and they didn't want to help with it. And they resisted it for literally months up until basically today.
That's what's most terrifying about this is that not only are they lackeys for the Trump administration, the leadership at HHS and other government agencies, it seems like, which is extremely scary. It's also that they behave as if they're a marketing arm for Trump Inc. Mm-hmm. Because it's not to prepare the country for a pandemic. It's not to get the necessary supplies in order in place. No, it's just to say, I see nothing, I hear nothing, you know, everything's going great and Donald Trump is doing a wonderful job in preparing the country for the pandemic. That's just not the reality and that's not your job. Your job is to make tangible improvements to our infrastructure so we can prepare for this. But it goes to show, that's what this whistleblower has revealed, that they weren't behaving like that. They were a part of the PR department for Donald Trump.
Yeah, we know that he cares about ratings more than one, anyone on TV, and two, more than anything else he cares about, and that philosophy has trickled down. It's the one thing other than urine that does trickle down, actually, is a belief that ratings and optics are the most important thing. I personally think that your ratings would be better and the optics would be better if you didn't create a situation where thousands of Americans were dying needlessly from a virus we had a month's head start on, they decided to go in a different direction.
Yeah, it's just, they can't think ahead. There's no foresight. It's just cleaning up the next mess and cleaning up the next mess. And not in a way, like it's like putting a Band-Aid on a leaky pipe. It's just to make it look better, although that would look kind of dumb. But
yeah, it could still trickle out of a leaky pipe with a Band-Aid potentially.
Right. Well, but that's the point in this terrible metaphor is that the negative effects are still being felt. But as long as the perception is that the negative effects are stymied, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. And well, and they're just like, as you're going to see, I guess we're going to transition it to it now. But thousands of deaths, that's not so bad. That's a crazy thing to say. But that's what you're getting on Fox News and out of Donald Trump literally every day. Laura Ingraham was back again like a day or two ago saying social distancing. There's no scientific basis for that.
No scientific basis. I covered it. I got so angry.
There's no reason that someone shouldn't sneeze in your face scientifically.
It's so obvious that it's insulting. And she knows it. She knows. Mm-hmm. There's no chance she doesn't know that, like, you know what would help a disease not spread is if people weren't in large crowds. No scientific basis for that extremely common sense fact.
Yeah, it's like I said on the show yesterday, we now have to defend the germ theory of disease. Donald Trump is full steam ahead, reopen the country, but he also wants you to believe that he takes this whole thing very seriously. And so I have compiled various pieces of evidence that lead me to believe that he might not. So one, the first, comes from his interview with David Muir last night, and it has to do with the empty cupboards that he talks about. Like, you know, like a rational person, they talk about cupboards being empty. He says that we didn't have what's necessary to stop this pandemic because Obama didn't leave him stuff to deal with a virus that we don't believe existed at that point. And a lot of people have responded since then saying, well, that was like years ago. What have you done? Well, now we actually have a reporter, since it's not a Fox News interview, that asked him that. And here's what he had to say.
You know, you're 3 years into your first term.
Yeah.
You're now applying for the job again. What did you do when you became president to restock those cupboards that you say were bare?
Well, I'll be honest. I have a lot of things going on.
For 3 years. Had a lot of things going on.
And you know what he did? As one of those things? Depleted the pandemic response unit in his administration. I wish Muir, I don't know if he followed up with that, but I wish he would have followed up with that.
Trump went off on a whole long tangent to try to distract the issue. That's why we cut it off. But yeah, 100%. Like, first of all, you did do some stuff in regard to pandemics, but it made us less prepared, not more. And I know it's like the most cliched thing to say, but you found time to golf a couple hundred times over those 3 years. Feel like, and by the way, it's not like we're saying you should have stocked the literal shelves. Put someone in charge of it, or
he's
at least
never,
don't take.
He's never lifted a plate above his shoulders in his entire life.
Exactly.
He doesn't know how to stock shelves.
Certainly not a baby. Just like I would say, put someone in charge of it. But the thing is, there already are people in charge of it. Don't fire them. That's all I'm asking of you. So look, that's one. His argument that the reason we weren't ready is because of Obama. Under the lightest bit of pushback, he folds. Like a flan in a cupboard. But anyway, so that's one. Let's jump to some of his other arguments. So he was asked about the new projections that just came out yesterday that it is likely that by June 1st, we will be experiencing more than 10 times as many daily infections every day and more than 3,000 deaths every day. That's the world that they're rushing to reopen. So he was asked about those projections, and here is what he said.
And then with these new projections, a lot of people do want the country to reopen quickly. Are you willing to accept these new projections that show that many more people will die within Iraq?
Those projections are without mitigation. We're doing a lot of mitigation. And we have to keep our country. We have to. Our country wants to open. The governors, it's in their hands, but our country wants to open. And you see what's going on. They have to open. And the people of our country should think of themselves as warriors. Our country has to open. Those projections are with no mitigation.
Okay, so there's a lot there that we have to respond to.
Incomprehensible. There was not one
rambling
long train of thought.
Yeah. So he of course ends with he wants to be a wartime president, and if he's going to do that, I like it this way rather than him invading Iran. I have to admit that. But he says we should think of ourselves as warriors. And my follow-up question would be, can we be like the sort of warrior you were during Vietnam? Can I stay home? That would be nice. I think it would keep me safer as it kept you safer during Vietnam. But anyway, of course, the metaphor is robust because he is, like in some wars, sending people to needlessly die. So that is true. But what did you think about that? His response about the new models.
Yeah, I don't know what he was saying, so it's difficult for me to respond.
That's true.
Because it's in the governor's hands. We're all warriors. Those without mitigation. He said mitigation three times. I don't think he knows what mitigation means. Who's doing the mitigating? Is it you? Is it the federal government? Is it just in the hands of the governors? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Again, in his annual chopper talk, or not annual, daily, I should have said, it's just a recycling, regurgitating of his favorite phrases over and over. And like, he just saw the two bullet points on the memo his staff prepared for him. And it included mitigation, and it included the country wants to reopen. He just repeated it over and over.
Exactly, exactly. And no, the country doesn't want to open. They just keep saying that. The polls consistently show people don't want
because
to.
Because if you keep saying it, then it makes it the reality.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. And realistically as well, even if it reopens, many people are not going to willingly run back into the breach. So let's just bear that in mind. Thankfully, some people are reasonable. Also, though, he said those models are with no mitigation. There's a tiny issue with that, which is it's just a lie. Justin Lessler of Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health, who did the research that the CDC was relying on there, says the scenarios factored in include some under which current measures are moderately effective, current mitigatory measures, and then they become half as effective going forward. Other scenarios include the assumption that current measures are highly effective and they're half as effective going forward as current measures expire. All of those measures that they've factored in, which is he is dismantling on a daily basis. So it's just a lie that it doesn't include mitigation. It does. And even with the mitigation, it expects that we might hit 3,000. You're trying to get rid of the mitigation on top of that.
And they know internally that it's going to be 3,000 a day. I mean, that's the thing about it. What's crazy is that we get these news reports about how internally the Trump administration is acknowledging that thousands of people are going to die every single day in the month of May, full stop. And then publicly, it's just garbled nonsense that contradicts everything that we've heard.
The experts are saying that whether we reopen or not, what we need right now is more testing. And if we hope to reopen, and certainly if we're going to reopen, we need way more testing than we're doing right now. So Donald Trump has heard those concerns, and here is what he thinks about the level of testing being done.
We have the best testing anywhere in the world, not even close. The antibody test, you see what's going on with that? That's going to be something that I don't... Look, we have so much testing. I don't think you need that kind of testing or that much testing, but some people disagree with me and some people agree with me.
So he's saying that the testing we're doing right now, he thinks, is too much testing. And some people agree with
him. There's quite literally no way that's possible, and there's no way that we could do too much testing in a pandemic. Pretty sure.
No, but well, so let's go to the numbers. And first of all, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to plug one of the only shows I actually ever plug in the show, which is take a little bit of time to watch John Oliver, because his last show was all on testing and it was a great job. But he talks about some of the numbers. So at minimum, the U.S. needs to be testing 500,000 people every day. But a good target would be 35 million a day, depending on what scientists, not Trumps, you talk to. Currently, only 200,000 people are being tested on a daily basis. So less than
half. Too many.
Yes. Less than half the bare minimum is too much. That's what he says. And so he said that the day after thousands of people died from this. So it is rampaging still across this country. And he is doing everything he can to throw gasoline on it. And as he's doing that, he is stocking. Like, we've played the ads that took all of his March comments and showed the death toll. He just keeps putting those out. He is saying insane weaponizable things to disarm the American public against this thing that is killing them every single day. If you are part of the Democratic Party or the Lincoln Project, please take note of some of these things.
Absolutely. The idea that the United States is doing too much testing is crazy. And you see this talking point being fallen back on by both Trump and Jared Kushner when he does his terrified media appearances. That's what he looks like. He's literal deer in headlights. He looks like he's going to pee his pants. And he talks about how the United States is now doing more testing than anywhere else. That is true at this point. We are doing more testing because we have the most cases. But per capita, that's not even close. And we are way behind. And that's why we have to do more testing than anywhere else. So yeah. Per capita, the United States is not up to other speed with other countries. Italy, other European countries, other South Asian countries are way ahead of the United States when it comes to the amount of people in their country and how many tests they have available per capita.
Yeah.
But just their Trump is and Kushner and everyone else are relying on the ignorance of people that they're not going to look up the proportional numbers and are just going to take that at face value.
Well, and also, let's bear in mind, he also frequently says, we do more testing than everyone else combined. That is not true. You can take any three major countries. It's just an insane lie. It's not his most insane. I didn't even clip it out. But for David Muir, he started talking about how impeachment means that we couldn't do our cupboards or something. It happened like a couple months ago. What about before then? I don't know. But anyway, he said we had a vote on impeachment. It was 197 to nothing in the House. And you might think, well, that what are you talking about? It was 197 to nothing. First of all, that's not even enough people. No, he's just not counting the Democrats. He's saying 197 because it was Republicans to zero, even though they were Democrats. He's just making up numbers.
Yep.
You remember last week when Mike Pence got in a lot of trouble for not wearing a mask while going to the Mayo Clinic, and then he got criticized after attacking the reporter behind the scenes, and then he admitted, I should have, and I will in the future. Well, Trump was going to tour a mask-making facility. And before that, he was asked, are you going to wear a mask? And he said, a lot of things. He said, I think it's a mask facility, right? If it's a mask facility, I will. Yeah, I don't know if it's a mask facility. We're going to see Honeywell. They have done an incredible job on many fronts. I mean, I don't know what job they've done because I literally don't even know what they make. But they've done a great job. If it's a mask facility, which it is, but I'm not sure. Later, at Joint Base Andrews, he said, I haven't decided because I don't know. If it's a mask environment, I would certainly do that. I'll know when I get there, but I would wear it. If it's a mask environment, I would have no problem. I'm supposed to make a speech. You'll tell me. Should I leave the mask on when I'm speaking? I don't know. It doesn't sound right. But if it's a mask environment, I would certainly wear a mask. Spoiler alert.
It's all a mask environment. What are you talking about?
First of all, the whole country's a mask environment. It is definitely a mask facility. And spoiler alert, he didn't wear a mask.
And I love, like, he thinks he has to wear a mask only when he's in the mask's natural habitat.
It's respectful to mask culture.
He wants to show cultural sensitivity. Mm-hmm. So he goes to where the masks live and where the masks worship. Mm-hmm. He wears a mask himself.
That's true. And he didn't wear a mask. And just to be clear, they make masks there. He should know that. Before he compliments them. Honeywell employees working on the production line were wearing masks, and a sign in the factory said that everyone there is required to wear a mask. White House officials said Honeywell said the White House's visitors did not need to wear masks. Yeah, that's probably what they did. Just an interesting note to add onto this. At one point during his tour, the Guns N' Roses cover of the James Bond movie song Live and Let Die was being blasted from the factory's PA system as workers performed the test. That's a pretty good cover there, too. So... he's walking around without a mask because, again, and I cannot remind you of this enough, conservative masculinity is dumb and weak and pathetic. That's all it is. And
well,
if
he doesn't want it to mess up his hair. If it's the N95, it has to go behind, right? You don't want to tousle that mane, and it might just disintegrate upon being touched with acidic fingers.
And I'll remind you of something he said on April 3rd when he was asked about the fact that the government was telling everyone to wear a mask. He said, I just don't want to wear one myself. I'm feeling good. Again, weak
and then
and dumb
I'm feeling
and
good by whatever. Damn it.
Oh, Michael Bublé, I think it is. Is it Michael Bublé? I'm not sure.
No,
anyway,
don't start a joke if you can't land it.
No.
Emma, stupid Emma.
I think at one point on the live show, Jesus used to have a stamp animation that would play and it would say fail if somebody made a mistake. I need to get that.
Yeah, I need it in post.
But anyway, yeah. So look, the thing is, it's stupid of me to say, but a leader should be able to be expected to provide an example for the country. It's Trump. That's stupid. How about this? Provide an example for your own people, you stupid, stupid moron. Because he is every day providing all the incentive necessary for all of these poor, dumb people who follow him to endanger themselves and the people around them. That's what he's doing. This is a joke. It's funny, kind of. But it's also going to get his fans killed. Emma, if you end up covering some of these rallies later this year, please be careful. Because there's probably going to be a lot of coronavirus there.
I would imagine. I can't even imagine like going to a large event. For my birthday, my boyfriend got me like, you know, a bunch of StubHub gift cards to use for a Giants game of our choosing. And I feel like, I don't know. I might have to wait a whole year to cash that in.
That's true. Next to my fridge, I have a little hook, and on the hook, I have all the badges for different things I've covered as press or different cons I've gone to and stuff like that. And the most recent one on top is a press badge for the LA Bernie Sanders rally.
Right.
And it both feels like forever ago, but it also seems so weird that like Edwin and I were standing like listening to Public Enemy surrounded by thousands of people. How?
I know. That's so weird. That day I flew back from LA from being there that week.
Yeah.
I can't believe I was on a plane and then I was supposed to go to Puerto Rico.
Exactly.
Had to cancel that trip.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh. What's the scariest headline that can be in the news these days? Ruth Bader Ginsburg goes to the hospital, and she did again. After the court's first day of oral arguments by phone on Monday, Ruth Bader Ginsburg went for outpatient tests at a hospital in Washington. Those tests, according to the statement, confirmed that she was suffering from a gallstone that had migrated to her cystic duct, blocking it and causing an infection. She is apparently currently resting comfortably and will participate in Wednesday's oral arguments by phone from the hospital. She expects to stay in the hospital for a day or two. She seems to be in fine health. I'm mostly covering this in case you've seen the headlines and you're very worried. She seems okay, but still, it is scary for her and for everyone.
Of course. Living legend, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She keeps, us on our toes lately, but I obviously am such an admirer of her strength. It's just so cool to see someone so late in their life, like really taking their health so seriously and the way she's exercising and keeping her mind and body in shape. We need her. Mm-hmm. I have a ton of fears that Trump is going to get reelected. I think Biden would lose literally any other election, except this pandemic does throw many different factors into the mix.
Yeah.
So we can't say. I have no idea. There's going to be mass voter suppression even in November, just based on people not choosing not to vote. That usually helps the Republicans, but in Wisconsin it didn't. So who the hell knows what's going to happen? Again, you know, we need her to stay in good shape because I think it's a coin toss who's going to be president come 2021.
100%. Yeah, there's going to be voter suppression, and we know everything we need to do between now and then to make it possible for every American to vote by mail, and they're not going to do that because that would result in more people voting by mail.
Kudos to Kamala Harris, by the way, who, you know, we've been critical of, but she was proposing multi-billion-dollar bill to spearhead mail-in voting, and the Republicans shooing that away.
Because they don't want people to vote. Right. But yeah, obviously, like, it's there's certainly the electoral consequences that you're talking about. But also, and again, it's not to say that she's like perfect or anything. Obviously, no human is. But she is a very inspirational figure and has been for a very long time for a lot of people. And so you don't want to see her sick or suffering or potentially dying just, you know, for her own reasons. I want to show you one thing. This is a video you've probably seen before, but in reference to her health and concerns being expressed, even the sort of concerns that I'm expressing right now, she would probably have an issue with. Here is a little bit of video of her from back in the day.
There was a senator, I think it was after the pancreatic cancer, who announced with great glee that I was going to be dead within 6 months. That senator, whose name I've forgotten, is now himself dead. And I am very much alive.
There's a little bit of Queen of Thorns in there.
Oh, yeah.
He's now dead.
I love that. Very Olenna Tyrell, for sure. That was bad. That was badass.
Yeah. Hope she gets better. Hope she feels good. The New York primary is again a primary, thanks apparently to the efforts of Andrew Yang, who we'll get to in just a second. But you might remember we talked about not long ago when the Democratic Party in New York took the opportunity to just cancel democracy with Jay Jacobs at the time saying, we shouldn't have non-essential primaries. There's only one candidate who is running, which of course is not true. But anyway, that's what they said, and they canceled it. And in response, Andrew Yang filed a complaint against that, saying that it was taking away the rights of him and the other candidates who are still very much on the ballot. And thankfully, that was listened to. And Annalisa Torres, Southern District of New York judge, said, the court concludes that plaintiffs and plaintiff interveners have shown a clear and substantial likelihood of success on the merits of their claim that the Democratic Commissioner's April 27th resolution removing Yang, Sanders, and eight other Democratic presidential candidates from the ballot deprived them of associational rights under the First and 14th Amendments to the Constitution. And so it will be back on. As of today, anyway. And so for those of you who want to vote for one of these candidates, especially Bernie Sanders, maybe you've volunteered and donated and, you know, invested a lot of yourself in this, being able to vote for him is something that you, I think, have earned. It's something that you have the right to do.
I'm a New Yorker. I was pretty devastated that I wouldn't be able to cast my vote for Bernie Sanders. Now I get to. So thanks to Andrew Yang and the people who fought to ensure that this primary would continue. There are other elections happening, and the New York Board of Elections was fine with, you know, conducting the rest of those by mail, but it would actually endanger people's lives, what they argued, to add just a little more text, one more piece of text at the top of that mail-in ballot. when it came to the New York presidential primary. It was absurd on its face. It was meant to kneecap the Sanders movement, which needs all the delegates it can get to influence the presidential platform at the convention and the DNC platform and all the rules going forward. Bernie needs to hit a 25% threshold. And I plan on voting for him to hopefully allow him to do that and just cement and put to paper my belief in his vision, especially when it's up against Joe Biden's non-existent vision.
Yeah, I agree. And I am glad for you that you get to do that and that many others will as well. I wanted to just briefly read a statement that was put out by Andrew Yang in response to this. He said, "I'm glad that a federal judge agreed that depriving millions of New Yorkers of the right to vote was wrong. I hope that the New York Board of Elections takes from this ruling a newfound appreciation of their role in safeguarding our democracy." I hope the same thing because, man, there's problems in state parties, but New York, whew, what is wrong with you people?
New York, look, it's whenever you have, and I think you see this kind of in New Jersey as well, and even in Massachusetts, areas that are blue but have a lot of concentration of wealth, like New York does, like New Jersey does. Surprisingly, I know everyone thinks Jersey's trash, but there's a lot of wealthy people here. And same in Massachusetts. The parties there, the Democratic parties, become fairly institutionally corrupt. But I'd agree with you, John. New York, it kind of takes the cake, as we saw throughout, the much publicized primaries when Cynthia Nixon was running against Andrew Cuomo. Yeah. And then, of course, all the malfeasance when it came to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's insurgent run against Joe Crowley. So yeah, those are just some of the examples of New York Democratic Party just being completely corrupt to its bone. And part of it is because of its leader, Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah, who people are saying in the chat has already appealed the decision. I hadn't seen that yet when we went live. It sounds like something he would do. But anyway, look, it looks like we're moving in the right direction, I hope. And I would like to see, like, the taking over and reformation of the New York Democratic Party has to happen at some point. I nominate you as tribute. You should run someday, Emma. Get in there. Fix things from the inside.
Why don't you run someday?
I don't live in New York. And also,
well, run in California.
I used to host the Common Room. They would barbecue me. Do you have any idea?
I tweet a lot, so
no, that's true. That is true. Anyway, and wait until they get a load of our chit chat hour. Most of America has been rightly focused on the coronavirus. That is the crisis that we're trying to deal with right now. But of course, we've been trying to do a good job here at TDR of making sure that we keep base with the other efforts that the Trump administration is sort of using this crisis as a cover to pursue. The destruction of the EPA, tearing apart regulations at a large, like meat processing plants and things like that. We have another as well, and that involves the border wall, something that you probably have not heard much news about recently, and it has to do with its paint job, which sounds like a silly topic, and sort of is, but it's an expensive one, and also one where the Trump administration's trademark cruelty is very much on display. The president's determination to have the steel bollards coated in black, he wants it painted black, has fluctuated during the past several years, and military commanders and border officials believed as recently as last fall that they had finally talked him out of it. They considered the black paint unnecessary, costly, and a significant long-term maintenance burden, but Trump has not let go of the idea, insisting that the dark color will enhance its forbidding appearance and leave the steel too hot to touch during summer months. And so we're gonna have some more details for you, but this is back in the news because he has tasked people in his administration once again with putting together an updated cost analysis of how much it would cost to paint it in a color that would conceivably burn people trying to climb it.
He's like a Sith Lord. I mean, does he not understand how comically and cartoonishly evil he comes off? This is like, again, it's like a movie villain.
Mm-hmm.
And a petty movie villain, which we know Trump is. But I guess they kind of relish that. I mean, Dick Cheney loved being talked about being Darth Vader and being a part of the dark side. These are people that embrace that. I don't think Trump sees himself in that way. I don't think he has the self-awareness of a Dick Cheney to understand that he's patently an evil person. But this should maybe give him some pause. I'm like reminded of the in Sleeping Beauty, the like black nettle spiky things that came out in the forest around the castle. I mean, that's kind of who he is. That's what he wants. That's what he envisions for poor immigrants just trying to get a better life in this country. And that's what he wants to do to them. He wants to literally burn their flesh if they try to come into the United States. And also just make it look really sick. Like
it's got to be scary.
It's got to be scary. And right.
It was black and pointy. And the analogy you just made gets even more robust in 1 second when we turn to that. But it's just and like you said, the Sith Lord thing, it's kind of like the Death Star, too, because it has a weakness. It's not a thermal exhaust port, but like you can go to Home Depot and get a saw that cuts through it. So, like, and by the way, Trump.
Or just swim around it.
That's true. But the black gates of Mordor, someone says, the paint doesn't make it saw resistant. But anyway, and I mentioned how expensive this is going to be. It is very expensive. So minimal $500 million. That's just for acrylic paint that'll wear away. $3 billion to powder coat it. So, I mean, you know, powder coating. You want to go with the powder coating if you can, but it's going to cost you more. By the way, even the steel itself, which is designed to be weather resistant, has a 30-year service life. So, like, by the time Don Jr. is ending his second term, we're going to have to replace the wall that we already had. So this is a very long-term maintenance cost problem. But anyway, you talked about the nettles that are designed to like stick people and stuff like that. So it's not just that he wants to paint it black so that it can burn people. Remember, and I am going to bring up this story as many times as necessary because I cannot believe that people have forgotten that this happened. But this is news from last year. Privately, the president had often talked about fortifying a border wall with a water-filled trench stocked with snakes or alligators, prompting aides to seek a cost estimate for alligators.
He's a toddler. Again, he like read a book about castles that like when he was in sixth grade, he was like, that's a good idea.
Yeah, he had his people checking to see, I guess he was calling the Tiger King probably at this point. Like, what if we got cougars, put them in the water, swimming cougars? But also he wanted the wall electrified and he wanted spikes on top that could pierce human flesh. So
sharks with laser beams on their heads,
freaking heads. If you get past the alligators with laser beams and then you climb up the burning hot fence and you don't get shocked by all the electricity, and if you get over the spikes on the top, he does have a backup plan. He wanted soldiers to just shoot migrants if they threw rocks. He was told you can't do that, it's illegal. So then later on he brought up, what if we just shoot him in the legs? And they told him you can't do that either.
He's so stupid. Like,
I mean, stupid is one way to put it. I would use a term other than stupid, potentially.
No, I know. Yeah, but there's many adjectives, but that's just one that just sticks out to me. Like, people always talk about, like, what if his plan is this? What if his plan? He's got no plan. He's a child. He's arrested.
He is. He wants
emotionally and intellectually.
Like, what are you supposed to say when, like, the idea that the right puts out is, What if we made it so that the migrant kids get eaten by alligators? Oh, by the way, we're pro-life. What are you supposed to say to that? Like, how are you supposed to, like, well, let's compromise. How about this? We'll go 50% of the way to we feed migrant children fleeing violence to alligators.
The alligators will just bite off legs. We'll do tiny alligators to bite off legs. There we go. Thank you, Pelosi, for the grand bargain.
God. They gave him billions of dollars. Thankfully not for alligators, but they've given him billions of dollars for it. Very excited to now welcome to the channel candidate for Congress running in Washington's 6th District, Rebecca Parson. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you here. I'm looking to learn a little bit more about what you're bringing to this race, your experience, hoping that a bunch of people out there in your district we'll discover that as well. So what made you make the decision to run this particular race, and what's some of your experience?
Yeah, well, I've always been involved with progressive organizing and activism. Out of college, I was a human rights observer in a Zapatista community in Mexico and served in AmeriCorps, lots of other stuff over the years. But after the 2016 election, I wanted to get involved politically beyond just voting and paying attention to politics. And so I got involved with my local Indivisible group. And what I found there is that, you know, we could contact our representative, Derek Kilmer, and ask him to take a stronger stand against Trump. Progressive activists have been asking for years, support Medicare for All. We support the Green New Deal, these progressive policies. And we always just get back these form responses that much ado about nothing. There's a lot of words, but not much content, and don't commit to changing anything. And it got to be really frustrating for me because our district is really suffering. I'm in the 6th congressional district, which is Tacoma and the northwesternmost tip of Washington state. And it's a working class district. We don't have the big Amazons and other companies that Seattle has. We have the largest port, one of the largest ports in North America. We have a broad swath of the district that used to be timber country. We have people working low wage service jobs and people who are literally dying, waiting in line for drug treatment. They are living in the woods or living on the streets and dying on the streets, getting priced out of housing, and really serious things happening, not being able to get good jobs. And, discovering that our district has been blue for 55 years and that we have the 11th most conservative Democrat representing us who refuses to adopt these policies that would help those people that I was just talking about, really frustrated me. And I'm just really fed up with hypocrisy and stuff.
You
like,
and me both, actually.
Yeah. He calls himself the national leader on getting money out of politics, but he's taken over $3 million from corporate PACs. Like, come on. Or climate change is real, but all we need to do is some, carbon dividends or some tax credits. Like, no, that's not enough. And that kind of saying one thing, doing another, just can't stand it.
Well, that might be the answer to my next question, because I'm curious, because you pointed out the district has been blue for a very long time. It's got a history. You go back, labor rights, workers' rights movements, things like that. It has this sort of deep-seated history, and yet you're saying that the current incumbent really doesn't represent what seems like the natural evolution, the natural conclusion of that sort of history. So why the disconnect there? Is it about sort of being able to manage his image in terms of public statements, and that's distracting people from what he's really doing? How exactly did they end up in this position?
Well, he took over from the 30-year incumbent before him. His name was Norm Dix. Norm Dix hand-selected Derek Kilmer to succeed him. Norm Dix stepped down. Derek Kilmer stepped forward to run. Nobody ran against him. And then Norm Dix, Derek Kilmer won. No other Democrats in the race. And then Norm Dix handed off all of his donors to him. And then Norm Dix became a lobbyist for a Boeing or a defense contractor. And so it's really just this kind of succession of, it's like an old boys club and these kind of backroom dealings. Like, yes, there was an election, but why was nobody else running? Like, why am I the first woman to ever even run for the seat, not to hold it, but ever to run for it, or the first LGBT person? And so because of these things where we have, like you said, this deep-seated history of populism and leftist organizing in this district. I mean, when the district was first founded around the Great Depression, the very first representative who represented this district proposed a constitutional amendment to limit personal income to $2 million. And what is not a populist move? And then we've had socialists, you can go back and look at pictures, black and white pictures from almost a century ago of socialists in Aberdeen, Washington, where later Kurt Cobain would be from, getting together and they'll say Aberdeen Socialist Club in cursive at the bottom of the photo. Like, we have this long history of it. And I think it's really about that corporate money. And also careerism. Derek Kilmer is chair of the Democrat Coalition, which, for those watching who don't know, is the largest Democratic caucus in the House. It's very centrist. It's what AOC's opponent Joe Crowley held a couple cycles before Derek Kilmer. And being the largest caucus and having the most Democrats in their caucus, they put out these policy briefs. So, okay, climate change is real. Here are solutions, tax credits, stuff like that. And then everybody has to line up behind it and go with it. And they also do a ton of fundraising. He alone has given $1 million to the DCCC over the years. And so if you, it's just careerism. He's notching up, going up the path and trying to get as negative press as possible along the way. And so if you're looking for somebody to take out, who wields a lot of influence while kind of flying under the radar, Derek Kilmer would really be that, because being chair of the new Democrat coalition is a powerful position. And he works closely with Nancy Pelosi on stuff.
You've mentioned a couple of times what he says about money and politics and then what he actually does, both individually and also institutionally. We saw on your campaign website, you write, quote, "He's so cozy with lobbyists that his former chief of staff is now a lobbyist who coaches other congressional chiefs of staff on how to schmooze with lobbyists." Yeah. That's an amazing long turn of phrase. So what are the implications of that? That he is so closely tied in and his staff is so closely tied in with lobbyists for various industries?
It's just this endless revolving door, and it means that they serve what the lobbyists want and what corporations want. You know, somebody, I think it was a PCO I was speaking with yesterday or the day before, a local Democratic precinct committee officer here in the district. And he said, you know, I really think that who you speak with the most, it will inform your thinking. That's just natural for anybody. And so if you are spending most of your time with lobbyists and with CEOs, you're being funded by, you know, Amazon and billionaires. He also belongs to the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is literally funded by Republican billionaires. And if you're spending all your time speaking with these people, that's going to inform your worldview and what you think should be done about policy. If, like me, you spend your time speaking with homeless people, and like a big portion of my campaign ad is at a homeless camp in Aberdeen, or if you have friends, like I have a friend who's a diabetic, and he's on the ACA. He's one of those people who's underinsured. And so he couldn't afford insulin for years. And as a result, he had a massive heart attack and almost died. And so that's who I spend my time talking to. I'm not talking to, you know, lobbyists for Uber. I'm not part of this revolving door. And so I think that's the real cause of that. That's what the consequence is.
Rebecca, you talked a little bit about some of your activist work that you've done internationally as well. And I'm always interested in when I talk with a candidate who hasn't come up through sort of the expected cliched way that a lot of our legislators do, what is that going to then bring to the way that they represent different groups, the ideas that they come up with? And so there's a couple different aspects of that I want to ask you about. I mean, you mentioned doing being a human rights observer internationally in Mexico. What does that help to bring? I mean, as you're out there and you're, you know, trying to figure out which priorities, you know, you're going to work on as a member of Congress, what do you think that might help bring to the position?
For me, with the Zapatistas, so they're a community of indigenous people in southern Mexico who are self-determined. They have direct democracy, they have economic democracy. They, from the very beginning of their movement, have fought for equal rights for women. And in Zapatista communities, they have clinics, hospitals, schools, where they have raised their own standard of life. And what that has shown for me is what can happen when people have direct democracy and they have a say in their lives, and where you're not just going into work and being told, okay, you're just, you know, part of, you're the cog in the machine. The machine exists to make money. Just shut up and do what you're told, because your voice doesn't matter here. You're just here to collect a paycheck and go home. And instead, I want a society where people have political democracy and also economic democracy, and they can decide what happens in the workplace and what goes on in their own life. Stuff like having co-determination, so having 45% of corporate boards be workers instead of CEOs and billionaires. That's the kind of thing that informs me. I'm also a commissioner on the Tacoma Commission on Disabilities. And from the very beginning of my campaign in July, I've had an extensive disability rights platform available for anybody to read on my website. And that informs me as well, because I have a friend who is blind and he uses a reader to access the internet. He offered to assess my site. He looked at it and he said, this is actually pretty good, but here are some changes you can make. Mm. That's a very small example, but it's still how many people would think of that? You only think of it if you interact with people who have a certain issue. You know, I have a friend who tried to go to detox, couldn't get in because there's only one in Tacoma that takes Medicaid. And so we went to the ER. I went to the ER with her instead. The ER is not a detox facility. They kept her overnight and then cut her loose. You're supposed to have 3 days of detox to be medically safe. That's the kind of thing I keep in my mind. That's why I always stick. Why people say, why are you, will you compromise? Will you go for something less than Medicare for all? No, I'm not going to negotiate with myself before I even start. And I'm not going to give up and subscribe to my own futility, which is what Democrats constantly do, because I have that in mind. Like that person, those people who are actually need detox and they could die if they don't get it, and they can't get it right now. So that's the effect that that kind of activism has on me.
You know, so one of the things that we've seen some new candidates move in the past couple of years, and at times have butted heads with Democratic leadership, at times have gone along with them, and sort of, I guess it sort of broaches the topic what you're just talking about there, is that yes, very often Democrats do just preemptively they come up with what they think would be a compromise, and they start with that. And then by the time it gets through the normal legislative compromise process, it's way, way to the right of even that compromise. Yeah. So what do you think about the prospect of having to fight not just against all of the Republicans, but let's say, you know, Nancy Pelosi is doing things the way that she does and all of that. What do you think about having to engage in potentially years of fighting honestly on all sides?
It's unfortunate, but I accepted from the very beginning that that's what I was likely going to have to do. And, you know, I wanted Bernie to get the nomination and become president. Sadly, that doesn't look like it's going to happen. But even then, I thought, Bernie's in the White House, there's still going to be a lot of Republicans in Congress and a lot of corporate Democrats. And what will my position be? And what am I committing myself to by running for Congress and intending to win? And that's part of it. And so, number one, you know, Republicans, they are by far worse than Democrats. On issue after issue. But then you have the Democrats who enable them, who give Trump, you know, his powers to use. And then when he uses them, they throw up their hands. Oh my goodness, how dare he? And like, clutch their pearls because he uses the power that they gave him. It's ridiculous. And so part of that I've accepted and said, you know, when I'm in Congress, I will have to fight Republicans, but I will also have to stand firm and hold my line against the leadership, against the corporate Democrats. And that's just the way it has to be. And I think something, a point that Crystal Ball has made a few times that I think is very good, is that progressives have to be willing to not be liked. You know, you don't get into Congress to be liked. And when they apply these pressure tactics to you, like, oh, but so-and-so from this, you know, red district, you know, she really needs you to vote for this so that we can get this win and she's more likely to win. Or, oh, she couldn't possibly win without corporate money. Don't you care about your colleague? It's like, I care about my constituents. You know, that's what you're supposed to be in Congress. You care about the hundreds of thousands or close to a million people who you're representing. And so if that takes being at odds with the leadership, that's what I'll do. And I think something that would be really interesting and powerful as well would be for progressives to form a corporate-free caucus, even if it's small, and work together and be willing to say, no, we are not voting for this, and hold firm and not be co-opted.
I think that a lot of people would find that very appealing, especially as they've watched the various rounds of back and forth over potential aid to, you know, people other than massive corporations during the pandemic. We could use something like that. Where can people find out more about both your campaign and also your platform?
You can go to RebeccaForWA.com and find out more about me there. Go to the events page to sign up to volunteer. No matter where you are in the country, you can help. We're obviously an entirely remote and online campaign right now because of the pandemic. You can phone bank from literally anywhere. Go ahead and sign up to do that. We're doing phone banking every day of the week. We also have something called Outreach for Introverts. So if you don't like speaking with strangers, don't worry. We have something for you. Also, please donate. I don't take any corporate PAC or lobbyist money. If you give even just a dollar, it does help because it funds 18 dials for our phone bankers. And I am also on social media. My handle on all but Facebook, Twitter, Instagram is Rebecca from WA, and you can follow me there.
Rebecca Parson, thank you once again for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.